This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition, iTunes and iPod Essentials.
If you lower the brightness, turn off Bluetooth if you're not using it, and check your email less often, you'll get even better battery life out of your iPhone. It really is that simple.
Chris Finn joins us with some valuable tips and tricks for your iPhone, iPod, and iTunes. Plus, some great product reviews.
It is a doddle to use. It's just really friendly, sort of soft application that doesn't get overcomplicated. It works the way that a child's brain works.
James Ellerbeck reviews some great new hardware and software products from our summer issue. All that and more on this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello again, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. If you own a Mac, chances are you own an iPod or an iPhone. With entry-level iPods starting at £32, Apple's family of portable multimedia devices is more popular than ever. So how can you take better advantage of all these great devices? That focus is on the front page feature in the summer issue of Mac Format Magazine, written by contributor Dean Mortlock. Packed full of handy tips and shortcuts, this complete 10-page guide will help you get the most from your iPod, iPhone, and iTunes. But due to a technical problem, Dean was unable to join us, but Deputy Editor Chris Finn, who has written dozens of articles about the iPod and the iPhone, joins us to fill in for Dean and talk about these great features and these great tips that are in this feature. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure, Brad.
Now, the masterclass breaks down these products into three groups, and let's talk about iTunes first. Your first tip is one that I didn't know about, and that's creating a virtual shopping list of music using the 30-second music or video samples that you get free from iTunes, right?
Yeah, I didn't know about this either, but it makes perfect sense. It's one of the things that iTunes Store is missing. It's missing a sort of wish list functionality, like you'll find on Amazon. All you do is create a playlist in iTunes, and then you find the tracks you want or the whole albums you want in the iTunes Store, and then just drag those tracks from the main window into that playlist, and that will just save the little 30-second preview snippet of that track, which you can go back to and listen again to. But more importantly, it lists everything there that you can just go in and see what you wanted to buy. It's a really nice little tip.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, number two is backing up your iTunes library. It's actually very simple, and it can be really useful down the road, right?
Sure. I mean, backup's one of those things that I get really, really, really boring about. If you talk to me for any length of time, I will tell you to back up.
Exactly.
Backing up is really, really important, and particularly with your music. Even if it's music you've ripped from existing CDs that you have, imagine the time it's going to take you to go back and re-rip all that music. It's going to be absolutely a real pain.
Right.
And songs that you've bought from the Apple Store, there's no redress, the iTunes Store, rather, there's no redress at all. Apple will not resell you, or rather, they'll resell you the same song, but they won't let you download it again if you've already paid for it. A bunch of different ways you can do it. Obviously, you can use normal backup things with Time Machine. The one that Dean's highlighted here is a cracker, which is just using the backup to disk command from the file menu in iTunes. Just go file, backup to disk, and just keep feeding blank disks into your Mac until your whole library is copied across. Do it on DVD if you've got a DVD burner rather than onto CD, because otherwise you would just be spending a fortune and chucking in loads and loads and loads of just CDRs. But it's a great way to backup your music. Make sure it's secure.
Our next tip is the right-clicking option that lets you get information or alter any of your tracks in your iTunes library.
Yep, right-click's fantastic. If you have a two-button mouse or a Mighty Mouse, which is programmed to activate a secondary click with the right-hand side, you'll be used to this. You right-click on something, or you hold down Control and you click on something if you've only got a one-button mouse, and you get a contextual menu popping up, giving you different options for the stuff you're actually looking at and pointing to at the time. In iTunes, you can right-click on a track, and there's a whole bunch of options pop up to let you actually go through and choose a few different things. You can get some info on the information, you can do things like resetting the play count, or you can do Reveal in Finder, which will show where that track is in the Finder structure, because obviously iTunes puts things in all different folder structures. So if you actually want to find out where that MP3 or AAC file is, you can do it that way. But the really nice thing here, and again, Dean taught me something I didn't know, is that if you right-click on the column titles in iTunes, you've got a few different options. You can actually really quickly go in and check or uncheck different columns.
Oh,
if you
yeah.
want to show the equalizer column, you want to show the composer column, you can do that, you can uncheck them. Or you can also auto-size the column or auto-size all columns to fit the length of text
right.
you have in each column, which is a really nice way of neatening up your window. Cracking stuff.
That is a really great feature. I just just did it as you were talking about it. It really works well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a cracking little tip, and it's one I'll be using all the time from now on.
Absolutely. All right, now let's move on to the iPhone and iPod Touch, the newest members of the iPod family. You use Safari on the iPhone and the iPod Touch to surf the web. While it's easy to use, it's cumbersome on a small screen, so you've got some great Safari tips reading about Quick Jump and how to use RSS feeds into your Safari browser.
Yep, that's right. I mean, Quick Jump's a really nice one, because if you're looking at a website on your iPhone or your iPod Touch, if it's quite a long website and you've got some way through reading the whole content, you probably want to go back to the top at some point just to, let's say, jump to a different page on the site or something like that. And if you're trying to flick all the way back up to the top, it'll take a long time, it's a pain. But you can just tap at the top of the screen and it will jump straight back up to the top of the website. It'll scroll instantly and it'll represent the URL bar as well. That's a really nice way of getting straight back up to the top of the site very quickly. Just tap at the top of the screen, boom, straight back up you go. The other thing, as you say, is RSS. Now, I use NetNewsWire on my desktop Mac, and I also sync those feeds through the NewsGator.com service. So I've got that reader on my Mac, which is how I prefer to read things. But you don't have to. You can read RSS feeds directly on the iPhone or the iPod Touch, and that's thanks to an Apple service at reader.mac.com. Whereas if you just click on an RSS link from a website, it will take you to that reader.mac.com site, which will allow you to see the RSS feed. And that's a really quick and easy and light and nimble way to view web pages, rather than waiting for all graphics to load up and that sort of stuff. And Dean suggests bookmarking the RSS rather than bookmarking the main site, because particularly if you're going over the iPhone's Edge connection, you want to be doing it so that it's nice and fast and zippy. You don't want to have to wait for lots and lots of graphics to load up. So that's a really quick and nice way to do it.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, our final area is the iPod Classic and the Nano. You might know about how to rate songs, but have you actually used it? If you're using smart playlists, it's really worth considering, right, Chris?
Yeah, sure thing. Ratings are a really good basic way of getting some solid metadata into your tracks. Rating songs is a really important thing if you're going to be using smart playlists, because you can use it as a really good filter. So if you're doing a random playlist based on a particular artist or based on a particular genre, you can easily filter that down to be only those which are rated 3 stars and above, let's say. And it's really easy to do in iTunes. You can right-click on a track and choose a rating. If you've got the rating column enabled, you can click and do them directly that way. But it's actually really, really easy on the iPhone as well, and on the iPod Touch and Nano. And those ratings that you make on those portable players will be synced back to your library once you reconnect the iPod to your Mac. To do it on the iPod Nano and the iPod Classic is really easy. All you do when you're listening to a song is press the center select button twice, and then you can scroll round and back to actually apply a star rating to that track. And on the iPhone, all you do when you're listening to a track, double tap on the album artwork in the center of the screen, it'll flip round and there's a series of little dots that shows you where you can place your star rating on there as well. Fantastic way of building up some ratings, and you can then, as I say, use those categories, use those that data in creating smart playlists.
And if anyone listening has an iPod, it's probably crashed and frozen up on them. So how do you reset an iPod? I know there's many different ways because there's so many different models, but give us some of the basics there.
On the newer iPod, it's really easy. All you do is you hold down the menu button and the center, the select button as well. Hold those down for a few seconds and eventually you'll see the screen blank out and it'll start rebooting. You'll get the Apple logo on the screen, and after a few seconds it'll be back up and working. On older iPods, it's the play pause and the menu button you hold down as well. So on newer iPods, menu and select. On older third generation before iPods, it's the play pause button and menu you hold down, and that'll reset those back.
Now let's talk about multiple iPods. More and more households have more than one iPod. So how do you sync multiple iPods with a single copy of iTunes?
There's a couple of different ways to do it, and Dean highlights those. One of the ways to do it is to create separate users for each of the people who have an iPod they want to connect to that Mac. The problem with that is obviously you have to have a separate library within each user, so you can end up with duplicate songs and all get very mucky. The much neater solution is to create a playlist for each iPod that you want to connect to it, and then in the preferences for that iPod, just choose to sync that playlist specifically.
Now let's talk about saving battery life and energy. Tell us about some of the tips there that are actually very simple, but you can easily overlook.
Absolutely. A lot of this applies to the iPhone and the iPod Touch as well, but there's a couple of specifics for the iPhone that we'll come with in a second. One of the most important ones is to turn the screen brightness down. Always keep the screen brightness down as low as you possibly can get away with. There's a few other things you can do. Try to avoid skipping lots and lots of tracks. Just listen to the tracks all the way through. The reason that saves battery life is that the hard disk based iPods cache the music to a little bit of flash RAM and then play it from there. And what they do is they cache that, and then the hard disk either spins down or it goes into a sort of dormant state. Whereas if you're constantly skipping tracks and moving things around, the hard disk having to work, those moving parts use up electricity as well, so your battery life will go down. As Dean says, make sure the hold button is on so that you're not accidentally pressing buttons when it's in your pocket, which will turn the screen on. And there's actually information as well on Apple's website. If you go to apple.com/batteries, and that links on your Enhanced podcast now as well, you can just click on that link if you're listening through iTunes. That'll give you some information about the sort of battery technology that are used in Apple's iPods and iPhones and, of course, Mac laptops as well. And there's some information on there about fast charging. It talks about as well the fact that if you don't use your iPod very much, you really have to charge it and discharge it sort of once a month. And there's even a little option there to download an iCal calendar that will remind you when to charge and decharge your iPod as well for sort of optimum battery efficiency. The iPhone, as I say, has got some specific things. One of those is the email. The email is set to auto-check every, let's say, quarter of an hour.
Right.
By decreasing the frequency of that auto-check, you'll save battery life. Similarly, if you don't really use Wi-Fi, or more importantly, if you don't really use Bluetooth, turn them off. Just go into the system preferences and turn them off. And that turning off that Wi-Fi wireless capability will really save you a bit of battery life as well.
Okay, Chris, thanks so much for pitch hitting for Dean Mortlock and giving us some really valuable tips on using the iPod, the iPhone, and iTunes.
No, it's my pleasure. I'm only glad that Dean wrote it because I've learned so much from this feature myself.
Yeah, actually, I have too. Chris, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Brad.
Chris Finn is deputy editor at Mac Format. The iTunes and iPod Masterclass feature appears on page 26 in the summer issue of Mac Format magazine. It's time to review just a few of the great software and hardware items featured in the summer issue of Mac Format. James Ellerbeck is the reviews editor who coordinates and writes many of the reviews, and he joins us now to highlight three products, one software, one hardware, and one an iPod accessory. James, thanks for being with us again.
Hi, Brad. No problem at all.
Let's get right into our first product. It's an early learning software package for kids. It's from Plax, and it's called Doozla version 1.1. It's a play-to-learn graphic design software package for youngsters. Tell us exactly who this is for and what it's good at.
It's for early learners who are perhaps up to about the age of 8 or so, and it's like a digital coloring in book. You get loads of templates and scenes and blank pages and a good range of tools just to make really quick designs, and it's really, really well built, very nice and tactile, and we just loved it.
Now, you think it's suitable for children age 2 and upwards, but you said in your review that it's still simple software that a child of 4 could handle better than an adult after just a few sessions. So it sounds pretty simple.
It is really simple. There's only 4 main sections, which are big, colorful icons which you click on. It takes you straight through to the page where you can do your designing. You can choose the tools. There's nothing to configure, and there's no questions that gets asked of you apart from do you want to save at the end. It just seems really basic and really well laid out. Anyone could use it, but I think it's going to be best for, say, a parent sitting next to a child who's just a few years old and, you know, getting them up to speed on this, yeah.
And on the main screen, you have a coloring in icon, a drawing icon, a webcam drawing, which, I mean, I guess is basically you can take a webcam image of yourself and draw on it, and then also drawing backgrounds. So take us from there and give us an example of what you can do with this product with a kid in front of you.
If you're sitting with a 4-year-old on your lap and you're staring at the main opening page, you could click webcam drawing, take a photograph, and then the child could very quickly be drawing on your nose or colouring in your hair. You could be drawing on your child's nose. It's just really fun like that. So that's what the webcam drawing side would do. The colouring in takes you through to a whole load of, well, quite a few templates of little fun characters which you can fill in, and then that's just a basic sort of drawing, colouring in and filling side. Drawing on backgrounds gives you loads of fantastic scenery, like, say, a shot of a pirate ship. Again, there's another 50 or so different scenes, and you can draw on them and draw trees or figures, or quite fun in that way. And then the drawing section, which is just a blank page which you can draw anything you like on.
And I think what really impressed me was what you said in the review, and that was you were really impressed by the flexibility, the ease of use, and the organization of the features, which made it simple for anybody to use.
Absolutely. It is a doddle to use. It works exactly in the same way your brain works. You only get asked one or two decisions to make throughout the whole process. It's just really friendly, sort of soft application that doesn't get overcomplicated. It works the way that a child's brain works. And I've been recommending it to everyone since I found it.
In fact, what you said was you couldn't find a single problem with this piece of software, which really says a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's no stability issues. Everything was solid. There was no hiccups. You didn't have to scratch your head about anything. I couldn't find any problems with it at all. It seemed like a very good quality product.
So that's Doozla Early Learning Software, £13, 5-star rating Mac Format Choice Award from Plask.com. That's Plask.com. And there's a link to it from our Enhanced podcast. You can also use a 30-day demo that's on the DVD that comes with the summer issue of Mac Format Magazine. So you want to check that out, especially if you have kids. Our second product is from Centris. It's called the Micport Pro. It's a USB mic amplifier, and this is not for everyone, James, but it has a specific need, especially for podcasters like you and me.
Yes, it's for anyone who has an XLR microphone, or it could be an XLR signal coming from another audio source, who wants to digitize that signal so they can record it on their Mac. So it's pretty good if you've got one of these microphones, or you want to record, say, some music you're playing through a guitar, and you want to digitize that signal and get it on your Mac quite quickly.
Yeah, so it's for podcasters and musicians, that sort of thing. And what I like about it, and I have one, by the way, in fact, we're recording on it right now, is that it's so simple to use. It doesn't require any drivers to install. It's ready to go immediately, and more importantly, so small.
Exactly. And if you're going out with your laptop in a bag and your microphone, this mini amp will take up no space at all. And yeah, really, really easy to use. You've got volume controls, input control on top of the stick. And you can also monitor the signal through headphones. There's a headphone port on it.
The only thing that you didn't like about this, and you gave it 4 out of 5 stars, was the price, which is about £110. A little pricey, but in my opinion, it's worth it if you need that small size, especially if you're in the field.
Price is quite subjective. There will be different depths of pocket out there, and for some people, it won't appear to be that expensive at all. For my needs, I thought it was a bit pricey.
All right, so the Centris Micport Pro, James gave it 4 out of 5 stars. I give it 4.5 out of 5 because I really love it. And I got to say, I really love it because it's so small and compact, and this is great to use, say, at Macworld Expo in San Francisco, and you're sitting in your hotel room and you don't want to pull out a bunch of junk. This is fantastic because of the size. But that's the Micport Pro, 4 out of 5 stars, £110 from Centris. That's CENTRANCE.com. You can get to it through our Enhanced podcast link. And our third and final product is in-ear earphones for your iPod from Denon. These are the Denon AHC751, £140. Yes, very expensive, but when you want really great sounding audio in a great sounding iPod, sometimes it's worth it, James, right?
Exactly. If you're spending 3-4 hours a day with your iPod listening to music on your way to and from work or at work, you might as well invest in a decent pair of earphones, which are going to give that big chunk of time a little bit more color, a bit more of an engaging sound, and these earphones are just fantastic.
Let's talk about the audio quality. You wrote that every part of the audio profile is well formed here, that it was live and punchy, especially with thumping rock, and the bass was really full. Tell us more about how you really experienced these.
I listened to music for about 5 hours every day. They just seemed great. They were great at presenting all of that audio. They didn't loosen up at any points. They weren't overly bright. The bass was engaging without sort of blowing you away. And the melodies were all there as well. It just seemed a very nice, engaging package. And they're very comfortable to wear as well, which really helps.
But it must be difficult for some people out there who have bought a iPod, say a third generation video iPod for £140, to turn around and spend another £140 just for earphones.
Yeah, absolutely. They're a luxury item. There's no way to really justify it as a necessity. The earphones that come with your iPod are perfectly good, and people spend the whole life of their iPod with those earphones, and they're perfectly happy. But if you listen to these and compare them to the earphones that come with your iPod, you'll notice a massive jump up in audio quality. And for me, music's a big part of my life. I just think it's worthwhile, a worthwhile investment, yeah.
Exactly. All right, the Denon AHC751 in-ear earphones, 4 out of 5 stars from James in his review. They are £140 from denon.co.uk. All right, James, thanks so much for going over these three products. We'll see you in a couple of months.
Okay, Brad, you're welcome. Anytime.
James Ellerbeck is the reviews editor at MacFormat. 13 pages of reviews begin on page 81 in the summer edition, which is on sale now. Want to kill off doing repetitive tasks or find the right matching colors for that brochure you're designing? Well, we've got two great shareware picks that might fill the bill and a surprise bonus app that we'll talk about later, all courtesy of our resident shareware expert, Craig Grinnell. He joins us again this month with his favorites that you'll find in the summer issue of MacFormat. Craig, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Brad?
Very good. Let's get right into your picks for the summer issue, and let's begin with Keyboard Maestro version 3.0. It's £18 from keyboardmaestro.com, and you can get to it right now from our enhanced podcast link. Keyboard Maestro is a macro program that enables you to banish repetitive tasks by building action-packed macros. Now, Craig, tell us a little bit more about what this actually means.
Well, what Keyboard Maestro enables you to do is create actions that can be triggered by things like keyboard shortcuts or at a set time or when a system event occurs, such as an application launch. So, for example, you can use user-defined triggers to open applications, such as I use Control-Option-C for iCal, or set certain applications to launch alongside other ones.
Now, Keyboard Maestro isn't the only application of this type that's out there, so is there anything that sets it apart?
Well, the thing is, as the price might show, it's kind of more of a professional app than some of the other ones. It's got an awful lot of flexibility and power under the hood. One of the main things is it enables you to combine actions, so you can create very, very complex macros, and these can be launched in context. So, for example, you can create macros that work within specific applications only. One example I've had was I created a workspace for a web design project, and with a single keystroke I opened up an FTP client, a web design app, and a bunch of relevant finder windows, like the relevant folders in sites and documents, and also positioned everything on screen exactly how I wanted it.
That sounds good, but complicated to set up. Is that the case?
To be fair, it's not the simplest tool around. You know, you're not going to be going straight into Keyboard Maestro and getting everything exactly how you want it. But it does enable you to record macros live now in the new version. That kind of helps, although you do have to subsequently tidy up steps to kind of remove junk and unwanted elements. Also, you can enable and disable groups as well. So, you know, if you do this sort of macro or something and it clashes with something else, it's easier to turn things on and off. But, you know, once it clicks, it's a pretty good app.
You gave it 4 out of 5 stars. What was your thinking behind that rating?
Well, it's very good at what it does. It does enable you to banish those repetitive tasks, and it gives you the sort of flexibility for doing that. The thing is, it is pretty complicated, and the help files are utterly dreadful, in my opinion, although there are some online videos that kind of compensate for that somewhat. I think the UI could be better. It's not particularly friendly. It's not entirely obvious to begin with what all of the icons do. And bizarrely, and this is the biggest minus for the UI, there's no search. So if you've got hundreds of macros, it's, you know, you kind of have to scroll down the list to find the thing you want. And the background engine saps processor cycles as well. We noticed it was up to 10% of our processor was dealing with Keyboard Maestro some of the time. So I think that kind of sounds a bit overtly negative there, but the thing is, there are an awful lot of pluses for this. It does enable you to do an awful lot of things with a couple of keystrokes, which can save time and sort of compensate for all the negative things. And so I thought it was, you know, the rating was justified on that basis.
Okay, that's Keyboard Maestro. It's £18 from Stairway Software, and Craig gave it 4 out of 5 stars in his review. Let's move on to our second product, and that is Color Schemer Studio, £25 from colorschemer.com. And Craig, it's a professional color matching application. How useful is that kind of thing to a Mac user?
Well, the thing is designers don't tend to use color wheels very much anymore, but I actually was educated in art school, and, you know, it's one of the things we always came up with, is color wheels were absolutely essential to get color schemes right. So, you know, designers really do need color wheels. They enable you to work up schemes really, really quickly, find out what colors match other colors, you know, right from the off. Now, the thing is, a good colour wheel should be really flexible, enable you to save schemes easily, and offer a whole bunch of harmony types. And there used to be an app called Colour Consultant Pro by Codeline, but that's gone now, as of Leopard, which is a great shame, because I absolutely loved it. And I've been looking for a decent replacement ever since.
How does Color Schemer Studio measure up?
Well, I think it's pretty good. It has an awful lot of features in it, and there are a whole bunch of harmony styles that you can choose. You can also make schemes based on photographs. Now, this is a pretty old tip. A lot of designers will do this anyway. You know, you take a photo that has, you know, good contrast levels or a really good color scheme in it, and you base a color scheme for, say, a website or an advert or something around that. And Color Schemer Studio kind of does that in an automatic basis, and I think it works pretty well. Also, and this is pretty important as well, it's got built-in color blindness simulation. So you can check all your schemes against various types of color blindness.
Sounds good. Any flaws in this program?
Well, the main one is that it is entirely screen-based, at least as far as I could tell. There's no CMYK support. The interface also, it's a bit cluttered at times, a little bit irritating to use. And also, that there really aren't enough keyboard shortcuts to menu items. With an app such as this, it's really, really good to be able to, you know, very quickly and rapidly access different things, and those don't exist yet.
All right, that's Color Schemer Studio. Craig gave it a 4 out of 5 rating, £25 at colorschemer.com. And finally, our bonus application is Caffeine version 1.0.2. It's a free app from Lightwave Software, and you can find it at lightheadsw.com. Craig, what does Caffeine do?
Well, actually, it's a very little one-shot application. It sits in your menu bar, and it stops your Mac from going to sleep. You know, caffeine stops it going to sleep. You know, bit of a pun there, but hey. And it disables screensavers as well while it's on. Now, this is great in very, very specific circumstances. So if you're given a presentation, you don't want your screensaver coming on, or if you're watching a video and you're not, you know, doing anything else on your Mac, you don't want it going to sleep or a screensaver coming on. It's a really good app for just making sure your Mac doesn't doze off when you don't want it to.
And the thing that I really liked about it was that it's much easier than messing around with system preferences.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you've got a screensaver set up to come on certain times or sleep settings that you're very, very happy with, you don't want to keep messing with them all the time. So what you can do is you've got this sort of default setting, I guess, for your Mac, and you can use Caffeine to override that in the specific circumstances that you want. And it's really, really simple. You click on it in the menu bar, it overrides all your settings, you click it again, and it goes off. Usefully, it also includes a timer feature, so you can run it for a very specific period of time rather than, you know, clicking on and off as well.
And two other great things about Caffeine: you gave it 4 out of 5 stars, and it's free, and you can't go wrong with free.
Well, absolutely. And even better than that, it's got a really cute little icon with a coffee cup. So, you know, go download it right now.
Exactly. Okay, that's 3 great picks from the summer issue. Craig, thanks so much for joining us again, and we'll see you in July.
Yep, see you next month.
Craig Grinnell reviews shareware for Mac Format. His latest picks appear on page 100 in the summer issue of Mac Format, which is on sale now. We answer your questions here on Mac Format this week, anything from your iPod to your iPhone to your Mac, and Trevor Middleton is our regular answer man that helps us. Trevor joins us again. Thanks for joining us.
No problem at all, Brad. How are you doing?
I'm very good. We should tell people to begin with that if you want to send us your questions, you can do that to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk and tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Question one is from Andy Hewitt of Manchester. He writes, I'm trying to share files between my Mac and a home desktop PC via my wireless network, but I can't get the PC to see my Mac. When I enter my Mac's address, XP immediately tells me the folder you entered does not appear to be valid. Please choose another. I've tried to browse for the network, but again, with no luck. I'm not convinced that XP is looking for the network. Have I missed something? Trevor.
Okay, well, Brad, fortunately, Andy and I have sorted this problem out between us. What Andy went on to say in a second email was that he was trying to use Apple File Sharing Protocol to access his Mac from XP. And what I suggested doing was enabling the SMB protocol in order to communicate with PCs. It's a more PC-friendly way of communicating, and you can enable that in Leopard by going to the sharing system preferences. I've given Andy the detail. If anyone else wants the detail there, it's quite involved, but if they email me, I will send them that. So basically, enable the SMB protocol in the sharing system preferences, and then when you want to log on to your Mac, try using the Mac's specific IP address preceded by SMB:// and it's much easier to use that specific IP address than browsing for the network volume, particularly the first time you access your Mac. Incidentally, you should also make sure that NetBIOS is enabled on the PC. And again, I sent Andy a link to the Microsoft website telling him how to do that. If anyone else wants that link, by all means, they can get in touch with me and I will send it to them.
All right, question two is from Clive Gollidge in Durham. That's in Northeast England. He wrote us, I've been told about and learned how to use Jailbreak on my iPod Touch so I can download third-party applications. It seems that a large number of other iPod users have done the same. Just look on YouTube. But why do you never talk about it on Mac Format This Week? Trevor.
Okay, well, Clive, the simple answer is that no one's asked the question about it yet. I've had one question on jailbreaking the iPod Touch. This particular listener had managed to break his iPod Touch, but fortunately we got that sorted out with a simple reset. Now, I must admit, I've been downloading the beta releases of the software developer kit for the iPhone and iPod Touch, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to be coming out when those official, if you like, iPod Touch and iPhone applications come out. I take your point about Apple keeping tight control over software titles by releasing them through iTunes, but in the course of my work, I see a lot of PCs that have been pretty comprehensively trashed by malware, so I think it's perhaps slightly overcautious on Apple's part, but it is understandable.
All right, and our final email is from Cameron Mills in Manly, which is near Sydney, Australia. He wrote us, I work from both my MacBook and MacBook Pro. I have a POP email account via my website. I can easily sync email that comes to me onto both computers by leaving messages on the server for a few weeks. But I would like to know how I can sync my sent email across both computers. This way, when I'm abroad, I can still refer back to old sent mails that I might have sent from the MacBook. I know I can CC myself, but thought there would be a more elegant solution. Trevor, help him out here.
Okay, well, a little bit of background for those of you who aren't familiar with all these protocols that prevail on the internet. POP, or Post Office Protocol, is a protocol by which your email is retrieved from the server to your email software, and the software then deletes the copy from the server. And what Cameron is doing, as he explains, is leaving that copy on the server for a few weeks. Now, that's fine, but eventually you're going to have to delete the message from the server, otherwise your POP mailbox gets clogged on the server. Now, that's going to cause problems if you have more than one Mac, because your emails ended up divided between them. If you're going through this yourself, what you could do is just leave those messages on the server for as long as you can, and then delete them when there's a copy on each Mac. And you can do that by going into Mail's preference, into the advanced settings for the account you want to change, and it's a simple matter of removing a tick from a checkbox. However, in the long term, there is a newer protocol called IMAP, which leaves all your messages on the server anyway. So if your ISP or your hosting service offers it, I would switch to IMAP. If you have a .Mac account, you're already familiar with IMAP. It's this great thing whereby all your emails are available from every single device you want to access your email from. I have a MacBook, I have an iMac, and I have a Nokia phone. Each of them has my IMAP mail account set up on it, and each of them has the same emails on it. So, Cameron, in the long term, I would think about switching to IMAP if your hosting service or your ISP offers it.
All right, Trevor, thanks so much for tackling those questions this time around. We'll see you on our next episode.
See you next time.
And you can email Trevor with your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. Please tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to Dean Mortlock, James Ellerbeck, Craig Grinnell, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakularopoulou. You can always send your comments and suggestions to macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Join us again for our next edition on Monday, the 23rd of June, as we review the latest news from the Apple Worldwide Developers Conference. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.